author. Reading his new book.
What do you think?
I think it's wonderful.
Wait till you get to the good part.
Oh, yes. Well, as I've begun, I did notice on page 13 there's a change. Change the processing platform question. And it says, can you imagine?
Yes. Yes.
If our previous method was to induce memory by asking, can you recall, doesn't it then change everything? Now we say, can you imagine?
We are invoking a new wider range to account for the new data. Can you imagine? Allows for a more creative pathway to the mind. More open. What do you want?
So this is what Eyes Wide Shut is doing. It's closing the door on movies, basically, because Kubrick very well recognized that movies were going in a new direction, essentially, and that the position of the camera no longer mattered, right? Because you can pretty much get any image you want to using rear
perspective. Yeah.
So essentially now, what's happened is that Kubrick and Kubrick's films made us the director.
Right.
It made us see through his eyes. But the new visual medium is putting the movie inside of our head. It's almost as if we're seeing it from the perspective of the imaginary camera ourselves,
right.
Which was no longer possible. Things like the fourth wall, for instance, and other concepts like that of how you would only ever see three sides of any given room in most scenes shot on a studio soundstage. And the conventions used and everything having to do with the position of the camera. And this is very important to me in terms of the idea of how we are seeing our reality now.
You know, Mark, The Master was one of the last movies where I went to the theater and listened to music instead of the soundtrack provided by the director.
Oh, cool. And?
So on opening day, I it was a tough call, but I kind of sacrificed it and said, I'm going to see this movie for the first time. But just cut out the soundtrack and look at it through the lens of the camera that Paul Thomas Anderson conveys. And yes. I listened to this album called The Seer by a band called Swans, which is an epic album. It's about 2 hours in length. So it carried me all the way to the final meeting of Joaquin Phoenix and...
very cool.
But one of the scenes that plays so beautifully is that, you know, I'm watching the images and constructing my own story, and it's highly entertaining, and I'm incredibly involved. And I don't know where to put that because the album is, well, it's a monstrous album. But anyways, the scene where he goes to the doctor's office and he's looking at the Rorschach test, you know, the ink blots, was just such a transcendent moment for me to see when I went to see the movie, you know, like a week later and listened to it with the soundtrack. Because my inner voice is telling me exactly what that character is saying, looking at those ink block tests, right?
Right.
But that's me putting a voice into the character. So is it me seeing the Rorschach ink block tests, or is it the character seeing the Rorschach ink blots?
Right.
So anyways, to see what he actually says the second time around.
When you and I were having our discussion about Eyes Wide Shut in particular, and I basically proposed the idea, Kubrick made a silent movie with Eyes Wide Shut. He wanted to go and say, look, this is what cinema was all about. Originally, it was about where we put a camera and what that means in regards to telling the story that we're telling, essentially.
Yeah, it's like the closest film to Metropolis to come out since Metropolis.
Yes, yeah. And Bill and I did a lot of talking about this, three films in particular by Kubrick, and the three big ones, I think, The Shining, 2001, and Eyes Wide Shut. And I came to believe beyond any shadow of a doubt that Kubrick did not want you to watch that movie with sound. He had another soundtrack in mind, and that's another story. Obviously, it also involves the sync up, and it's pretty astonishing. I mean, it is, to me, to this day, I've seen it probably 40 or 50 times from beginning to end, and it is jaw-droppingly astonishing. The movie is a horrifying landscape under the musical direction of Roger Waters and the rest of the gang with Pink Floyd. But the point is that, so if you take, say, that you mentioned the scene of the inkblot test in The Master. Okay, well, the inkblot test actually represents the movie that we're watching, right?
Exactly.
And the psychiatrist is now, he's like the owner of the theater itself. He's there behind the screen, right? He's behind the movie as we're watching it watching us. So we're watching the movie and he's behind the screen in a position above the screen, looking back at the audience. And this is how I've interpreted the meaning of the first image of 2001, right? You have the sun, or you have a bright object shining at the center. This is the lens, this is the actual lens of the projector as it shines its light out. And then in between you have that lunar surface, and it's just the curved edge, the upper curved edge of what appears to be the moon. To me, this is the head of the viewer, basically, seen from behind the screen. And then finally, you have the curvature of the screen itself, which is represented as the dark side of this moon. And of course, when I first saw 2001, I saw it on a curved screen like that.
One of these
big CinemaScope screens at a midnight show. And I mean, believe me, my life was changed forever. But so this is what's being done in a sense. And it's very funny because that Paul Thomas Anderson chose to take on, and it's relevant right now too, because there's a new book about Scientology. I don't know if you guys have heard anything about that.
I just saw a clip of something about that.
Yeah. It's already in its second printing, and it's only been out for a couple of weeks. So it's selling like hotcakes in the States, and it's actually not being sold in Canada at all. I would have to order it from Amazon. I couldn't go get it at my Chapters or anything, or my local bookstore. But anyway, so.
But this speaks to a lot of things. With most people that I know, not that I know, but on Facebook and comments and stuff like that, the overwhelming commentary on The Master is, WTF, what the fuck was that about?
Really?
They
wow,
have
I
nothing.
I was so blown away by this film.
And then some people say, well, it's about Scientology. But the movie doesn't.
No, it's not.
I know it's not, but this is the conversation that most people have
I know, I
when faced
that.
With that movie.
I was talking to my neighbor, and he was like, oh, yeah, that was about science. I'm like, really? Because I would say it was more, instead of L. Ron Hubbard, what's his fucking name? The guy who came up with all the older prophecies, the medicinal guy who always recommended Rosewater. What the fuck? Spacing.
Edgar Casey?
Yeah, Edgar Casey. I would say that it's about Edgar Casey and make that claim, but I would sooner say that it's about Edward Casey than it is about L. Ron Hubbard. There's not much in support of that being about L. Ron Hubbard. He's got a whole different set of everything.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't necessarily. Well, I don't know. Edgar Casey was a very Christian man, though, wasn't he?
Right, but in the sense of what this first of all, just the guy's whole philosophy and what it is that he's presenting about
time progression.
And about reconciliating and this whole idea of he's basically presenting your Valis loop in a certain respect in his understanding. But the idea that he's like, I see what you're doing. You're changing it. This time. Like when he has that reaction to that woman. The Jurassic Park lady, what's her name?
Laura Dern.
And she's like, she's kind of kissing his ass, and he's kind of just like, fuck you. And it's like, that doesn't speak against, it's like, yeah, no shit, I'm making this up. That doesn't negate it. Like,
No. Well, hold on.
Fucking point?
Well, you see, I'm gonna disagree with you on this one, Dave. I think the movie is about Scientology in a kind of a special way. It's not directly about Scientology. I would agree with that. He's not taking a direct poke at Scientology, although maybe at L. Ron Hubbard and the relationship with Jack Parsons, a little bit of that there, because he does mention rocket fuel at one point when referring to the liquor that is made by Joaquin Phoenix. Yeah, he calls it rocket fuel. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they're actually having discussions that kind of fit a metaphorical model for Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard.
And but there's a preview where Joaquin Phoenix runs towards a port and he complains that someone stole his boat.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And what number is the pier? Do you remember that?
Oh shit! It's
there's a whole thing around that.
Yeah, it's connected.
I haven't followed that guys. But the point I wanted to make here is this. So, if you have my model of the opening image of 2001 in mind, with we see that the perspective is from who I would term the filmmaker as he looks at the audience from behind the screen, okay, watching his movie. And that idea is transported into the idea of an ink blot test where a psychiatrist, and this is the whole idea that I think that Kubrick was trying to get at with movies. I think that Kubrick was a sociologist, basically. He was a master programmer. That's what he was trying to be. That's what he wanted to be. And so if you take this idea and superimpose it into the master, there's a scene where we learn that Joaquin Phoenix has a position as a photographer for a period of time. And the music that Paul Thomas Anderson uses for that scene is a song called Get Thee Behind Me, Satan, basically. So what we're seeing here is a reversal of this concept of the filmmaker looking from above the screen at the audience from behind the screen. And now the character played by the lowly Joaquin Phoenix, who is just the audience member, is now trying to switch his position and get into the position of the Satan as the projector. Are you following me?
Yeah.
So, and I, to me, that scene is representative of what has happened to cinema today in the way in which we are now, and of course 3D is another good example of this, the way in which we are being drawn closer and closer, not to the position of the filmmaker, not to see the movie as the filmmaker does, but to see the movie as if we were a character in it, mm-hmm. basically. And considering, say, the Aurora, Colorado thing and other stuff, I mean, obviously that's a very complex issue and it's thorny. But the idea of human beings stepping into movies as part of the character and how it fits in with video games and the way in which our minds are being processed today, to me, it's just fascinating. But
yeah,
but you know, this is why. Go ahead.
The Purple Rose of Cairo. Mm. I was just recently taking that as, Crowley gets the Book of the Law in Cairo, yeah. channeled in Cairo, and
of course,
the idea of what's being presented there in relationship to the stepping out of the cinema screen
wow.
into the film, within the film. Like, yeah, okay.
And you know that Woody Allen is obsessed with magic, eh?
Sure.
Yeah, he's actually a sleight of hand magician himself, and he has references to magic in his films constantly, the Tarot. So, yeah, that's very interesting, yeah.
I wanted to make one comment about Scientology with the Master, is that what I think what Philip Seymour Hoffman recognizes in Joaquin Phoenix is this ability to be in any environment and find the necessary components to make a formula for transcendence. But this is in something physical, you know. Wherever he goes, he can make hooch. You know what I mean? He can make his rocket fuel. And I think that what Philip Seymour Hoffman's ability to do is, whenever he's in a room full of people in a public setting, you know, where people know that they're sort of on camera, he can find a way to be the center of attention. And he can find a way to drive the action. And what ultimately his goal is to be so dynamic in that environment as to sell them something when he leaves, so that he can come back as he circles the country and sell volume two. So ultimately, it's all about formula. It's these two people who have competing levels of formulas that they can utilize in situations. And I think Scientology's... what is amazing about Scientology is that its formula is so explicit. It doesn't hide its formula. You know, anyone can see that this is what all religions do. You know what I mean? So ultimately, any religion would want to compete with the other religions and be the number one religion. But if Scientology were to do that, it would it would crumble the whole system of religion, because enough people would get exactly what the game was all about. And so I just wonder about Parsons and Hubbard and their intentions, because, you know, Crowley and those dudes, you know, they weren't fans of major religions, especially Crowley, with his hatred.
I don't think Crowley hated Christianity at all. I think he hated the way that the Christianity was represented as a concept, basically.
Oh, well, that would be the religion. That would be the church. That would be the corporate structure, you know.
You're right. Yeah, well, that was jealousy of his own, because he wanted to be at the head of all of that. And that's what I'm saying about Kubrick, basically. And that's what I'm saying about the comment of the movie that is The Master. Go ahead.
There's something really interesting to me about the fact that here you have, when you look at the time frame of Crowley aspiring more than anything to be the world teacher, right? And then simultaneously, he's Europe, obviously, works for British intelligence, whatever, you know, beside the point. But here you have in the East, you have Krishnamurti being adopted by the Theosophical Society. At the time, headed by Madame Blavatsky, being told that he is the world teacher and having, you know, multitudes of people demanding that he be such, rejecting the whole thing and doing his best to point out that there is no, that there is no guru, that every man and woman is a star, basically. In his own words,
it's a beautiful,
deeper than that. But just the composition of the dynamic of that you have in the East, this guy rejecting it at all costs, that position, and this other guy aspiring and doing everything to push the opposite and through the opposite means. Krishnamurti's here looking to reject to put anything before you and that, and Crowley doing everything to present and work with what's between you and that, if that makes sense. They have opposite means.
I think you're dead on the money. I can actually compare that that model that you just represented to Christ, to the allegory of Christ in the desert, right? You know, Satan comes to him and says, if you will just call me king, I will make you king. Right?
Right.
But of course, Christ says, no, I'm not going to play that game. I'm not going to be some kind of guru, basically. But of course, what ends up happening to Christ is he is inevitably crowned king, essentially.
Doesn't that speak to demonic magic, to allow that force into your field of vision, to be offered? One thing to say, you know, I would reject Satan. But have you had Satan offer you the things he has to offer?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
What do you do when you are offered those powers or those objects?
Well, I guess you like David said, you could use Krishnamurti and Crowley as models of two, you know, disparate poles in regards to, you know, two distinct paths that you could choose. But what I find funny about it is the irony that Krishnamurti will achieve being recognized as a legitimate guru, whereas Crowley is everybody's favorite punching bag and laughable. People are constantly making fun of him. And it's almost as if Crowley managed to walk a more dangerous path.
Yeah, and it's so rarely expressed that it seems set up by the Theosophical Society, like that they knew exactly what would happen if they tried to do that to somebody.
Really?
Yeah. Because that's what Krishnamurti's words in essence become.
So if he was a lesser prodigy and he's like, hell yeah.
Well, he was originally named Alcyon. Right, which is the star that they thought to be the center of the the universe or whatever. It's like the brightest center of everything. The Theosophical Society named him such, like ordained him before he was 10 years old. And then the first book he wrote when he was 13, I believe, is called At the Foot of the Master.
Oh.
Where, where basically he presents this thing completely opposite, for the most part, to what he ended up presenting. He went in front of, you know, however many people, a multitude of people, and rejected his role as the world teacher in front of everybody at like the age of, I forget what it actually was, but he was a teenager. And so, you know, that, but it seems like played, like that was a card that was played, you know. I don't see how, you know, they could have not have known that that would be the result of them doing this to a child.
Well, that's interesting too, in the, well, yeah, what it would do to get, you're right. That's, I mean, ethically, that's a fascinating question, you know, but I mean, I think you can actually see what happens when you do it to a child, because the attitude towards the child inside and towards children today has changed radically over the last 50 years, basically. I mean, just the idea of the indigo child, for instance, the idea that there are these children who are born, and as soon as they're born, they're just spiritual perfection, and you ought to do whatever they say. It's just to give you an example. I went to this kind of outdoor music festival, sort of a miniature Woodstock, that was put on by a school for indigo children as a fundraiser, right? And all the indigo children worked at the food stands, serving food that they made. And they served me raw chicken. I took one bite of it and I went, yeah, okay, indigo my ass.
Right, right.
So, you know. just
Why has no one marketed a boy band called the Indigo Boys?
Oh, that's a good question.
Beautiful.
Yes. Well, maybe.
Have a sort of religious type following. They sing us songs, teach us miracles.
Oh, God, that's scary, though.
Well, I guess we had the Indigo Girls, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You just now realized that after you said the Indigo Boys?
No, I'm just following up. For listeners who didn't know.
Well, somebody spent a little time on an American college campus in the 90s.
Who was telling me? So I had a friend telling me that was the only movie he's gone to in the theater on LSD was the Indigo Girls movie.
What?
Oh, no, Spice Girls. I'm sorry.
Completely Spice different. Girls. Okay.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
who did say that? Was that? Why do I want to say John Philbright?
Was that on the line?
Maybe probably
that was on,
not.
Yeah, I think that was on our calls. I didn't realize that was on our show. I just remember somebody telling me that. I was like, what? That sounds like an interesting trip. I went to go see The Shining. I've told Bill this, but I went to go see The Shining on mushrooms a long time ago as the midnight show, and was ready to go right when it was supposed to start, and like 15 minutes went by and it hadn't started, and this guy comes out and tells us that the projector's broken, but we can go see Paranormal Activity. It's in the other room. if we want, and I didn't see it, I left, but that was kind of frustrating. I was already...
That's a big letdown.
That was a big letdown. It would have been one thing just to get let down with not getting to see The Shining in the theater as the midnight movie, but then to be told you can go see Paranormal Activity instead, fuck that.
Yeah, I'd love to see The Shining on the big screen. I would really love to. I saw it a
couple times on the screen. The best part in my eyes was just the things that are hard to recognize when you watch it on the small screen, like the Playgirl magazine, but the fact that Ullman has Carl Jung's The Red Book on his desk
before it
published, that's pretty incredible.
I was telling David this, but I finally got to see 2001 on the big screen proper.
Oh, nice.
And there's a million little tiny, well, not a million, but there's a lot of tiny details that just, because, you know, I'm scanning every inch of the screen for little nuggets, and tons of stuff were popping out.
The degree of that man's artistry is truly frightening. And I think that that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to scare the living shit out of people. He was, in my opinion, a satanic prankster, and he ought to be thanked for that, basically. And I really believe that cinematically he saw, or as an artist, he saw that his time was coming to an end in a certain sense, and he played his cards beautifully in regards to his film work in general.
You were saying you didn't really care for Eyes Wide Shut when you first saw it, Mark?
Oh, I hated it. I hated it. However, I had a nervous breakdown 5 minutes after I saw it. And I started laughing, and I couldn't stop laughing. I mean, I was literally on the floor laughing my head off like a stupid child. And I had just heard something on the radio that I thought was funny. And I started to laugh, and I kept laughing, and I kept laughing, and I kept laughing. And later on, I realized I wasn't laughing. I was screaming in horror at what I had just seen. No, it's true. That's the effect that film had on me, because Stanley Kubrick made that movie for me. He made that movie for every idiot who ever thought they understood what he was talking about.
That's awesome.
That's what he did. He put his all of the attention. That's what it says on the wall there when they have the gay bashing scene in Eyes Wide Shut, where Dr. Bill gets gay bashed. Well, on the wall it says, "I love you too." I mean,
oh, really?
Stanley Kubrick.
I feel like go back to San Francisco.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So, did you notice that? Well, I wouldn't expect if you didn't live in San Francisco or visit San Francisco, it's hard to catch this. But he's Dr. Hartford, right? Hartford, yes. Very close to Hartford. Hartford is the street next to the Castro. So,
oh, really? Wow.
That's actually Hartford is like the core of the gayest community in the world.
That's fantastic because he's that this is why he built his own set, because Dr. Bill is not really traveling the streets of New York. He's traveling the great global village, basically. That's why he's walking around the village. That's what it means. It's the global village. Oh, he's everywhere, walking on streets from all different periods of time in history, basically, over the history of cinema. Anyway. I think, that's what Eyes Wide Shut is as a movie.
I
want to
mention really quickly, Bill. You were talking about that advertisement that was made for The Master, where he's looking for Pier. I think Pier 32. I'd have to check that, but if it's 32, that's interesting because it's 32 pathways. But okay, this was a personal, by extension, personal sink that I thought was kind of funny that I couldn't help but notice is when I saw that advertisement. Amy, my girlfriend, went to school for psychology across from the pier that he's talking about in San Francisco. And the advertisement is actually for the Castro Theater that they made that advertisement for.
Jesus.
And so she lived across from the Castro Theater for a long time. When I met Amy, she lived at the corner of Market and Castro. And you could see the theater directly from she could go to her roof, and we'd spend holidays on her roof looking at the crowds down below directly across from the Castro Theater. But the irony of her working across from the pier and then is playing at the Castro Theater, which she lived across from, was just kind of funny. And then the gematria of her name was the same as the pier too, was something. I'd have to look it up again, but I went back and forth with whoever posted that a while back on just the intense irony of that whole situation. But even beyond the personal level, just the fact that what you're dealing with in terms of the film itself of The Master, and like just him on the beach making the woman with the sand, and the whole all the far-reaching implications of his struggle are definitely expressive. You could tie it in with that symbolism of the whole history of San Francisco and the whole deal. It's a lot to go into. I'm speaking vaguely, purposefully, for the reason of it being a lot to go into. But I should write an article on it. It's interesting.
I'm sure the whole the hippie scene and its connection to Manson and all that stuff would fit into there somewhere too. Basically.
Yeah, I can see what you're getting at with the naval aspect. With in the film with Hubbard, and
yeah.
I see the levels there. It's interesting. I hadn't really.
This is,
go ahead.
This idea of the film, whether or not it's about Scientology, is quite subtle, actually. Just like it's subtle when you consider the role of Scientology in the film Eyes Wide Shut, it's an important question to the movie. Rob Ager points out that. When Dr. Bill goes in to see Domino, the hooker, when he's in her place the first time, she's standing in front of a book, and the book is Understanding Sociology, basically. You know how Kubrick loved to throw these books in there. And this is what I think is what Kubrick was attempting to differentiate with his movies, basically, is that, and it's it's anti-Scientologist, all right? And that's the whole point, is that even it might not appear to be, but the whole concept behind Scientology is that very concept that we talked earlier about how nothing that's real can ever be done any damage, right? In a sense, going clear and understanding that principle that you mentioned from the seminar you talked about, the Christian one.
Oh, the Course in Miracles.
Yeah, Course in Miracles. Yeah, yeah. So it's the same idea. That notion at the beginning of Course in Miracles, that nothing that is real can ever be under threat, is very much the same idea as going clear in Scientology, right? And so, and this is an idea that is now pervading our reality. And this is why I see a shift, you know, from the post-satanic United States of America and something new coming up, something, a different beast being formulated, basically. Let's put it that way. And is that beast, or does it come from the moon? Is it lunar as opposed to solar? Because Scientology appears to be a solar culture, right? Whereas Jack Parsons, who represents that, I'm not quite sure what I'm getting at here once I get into Parsons.
I love it. I can totally dig it. I can definitely see Scientology as solar and Parsons role as head of the OTO in Pasadena. The OTO is very lunar. I can appreciate that. Yeah.
And I mean, Parsons himself called himself the moon child, right? So now if you play into a massive arc, like a hierophantic 2,000-year arc, if culture is truly going lunar, then it's going Islamist. It's going Muslim, right? Which is, of course, Muslims or the Islamic flags almost always have green in them. Sometimes they're all green.
Right.
And of course, they're a lunar culture. They worship the moon. Go ahead.
I find it interesting that Eastern astrology is based around the moon, whereas Western is based around the sun.
Exactly. So this is the whole – if you think of the history of mankind moving across the globe, we've gone as far west as we can, basically. So there's – you know, it's like water in a box, so to speak. There's a backlash, and the fertile zone is going to be the area, and that's why that area is under such – threat right now, is because it's about to become the center of the world.
Well, the only question left is time, right? We know where everything yes. is. We know where yeah. we are. That is, I mean,
time and, well, maybe not time, but this idea of novelty is what gets me, like, because it's a popular idea right now and it might be correct. Maybe there is some kind of event that's going to take place where we're going to reunite with a bifurcated time stream, like suggested by Terence McKenna, and go into an eternal golden age, which is a natural period, or something along those lines. I don't know. But I mean, that's the question that lingers with me, is are there a limited number of pieces in, I don't know what I want to just say reality. But what I mean by that is reality as a certainty. Like, is there a certainty that there is a maximum number of concomitant pieces that make up reality, and then once you have that, you're stuck with it, and you cannot have a novelty or a change come in. Well, so the time is always recycling.
Well, I mean, what used to be the defining characteristic of man's distinction from the animal kingdom?
What used to be?
Yeah,
I mean,
because for me, it
metaphorically, it's the use of fire or tools.
Fire walk with me, or yeah. to have control over that.
Yeah,
you know, I know I go over this over and over, and it's probably dusty and old now. But you know, if life emerged out of water onto land, what is the emergence of land into cyberspace?
Yes, if we go from, but oh, that's interesting then, because that puts water at the bottom of the system.
Is there a right? finitude for how much space and how many directions that you can go in cyberspace? Will east ever meet west as we have on land?
Yes.
Is there, will we find some programming feedback that says there is a limited amount of space in cyberspace? Or is it that when you fill the fucker up so much, it will hit a saturation point where it naturally folds in on itself into a sort of finite object, which is this understanding or this living gnosis that is sort of embedded into this new dimension that we've created.
Which, and that dimension is media, basically.
It is media.
I mean, and that becomes the simplest way to describe what first differentiated us from animals, is that we had the sense of separateness. That is to say, there was a media or a medial space between what was us and what was the rest of reality, basically. Right? And then this becomes the use of tools, which themselves are media. And, you know, McLuhan himself says this. And you're talking about, so you're saying, is it that there's a limited space, but it's not just whether there's a limited space, but how many different ways can the individual pieces be broken down, right?
Right.
Like, so, and this fits in with the idea of Pink Floyd from Metal, and the call, you know, one of these days I'm going to chop you up into little pieces. And the idea of editing, re-editing, copy and paste, and all the different things that we're doing, and then the natural things that occur that are syncs that people don't notice, right? Because this is the role. It's like media and synchronicity are related to each other. And this is what I was, you know, I've been working on for a long time and not really getting anywhere. But this idea that that as you reduce media contact, synchronicity also reduces. And this kind of brings us full circle back to that question about whether or not you could create a non-synchronous event. And that would be, it would have to be in a world with no media input whatsoever of any kind.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you guys, but I got pulled off the line. I got a call from Mitch Santel, who was Vinnie Eastwood's producer, telling me that he's really weirded out because when he tried to look me up, my homepage did not come up as my own homepage. It came up as Billy Shears, who was the guy who...
No way, replaced.
And he was like, I don't understand why it's doing that. But he was saying that it directed him towards a homepage of Billy Shears instead of myself. And he was like, do you know why? I was like, I don't know why.
Well, that's hilarious. That is very interesting.
He said it completely tripped him out.
I'm tripped out. David, was it you that made the Rosemary Woodhouse Facebook page?
Yes.
Okay, I was pretty sure it was you, yeah. Which I think is absolutely hilarious, quite frankly. I mean, that's a real coup to have that.
I scared some friends of mine who weren't familiar with the reference. I, like, befriended people that, I thought that they'd be hip to it, and they were like...
But that's interesting, because...
They were like, who are you? Do I know you? I was like, we had sex. And they were like... And then they got all...
Oh, man. That is hilarious. That's funny because...
So how many friends does Rosemary have?
I don't know. She's doing all right. She's new to Facebook, so, you know. But I liked role-playing for a little bit when I first... I mean, I haven't been looking at my own Facebook, too, actually, for the most part. I haven't been on it much recently. I've been so absorbed in my art world. But when I first got into it, I did a lot of the role-playing of, like, different, you know, I was like, who's my son? Well, my son is Andy, but he's you might know him by lysergic acid. or I called him LSD. So like
LSD, that's hilarious.
I was wondering why you had said that Jack Parsons called himself the Moonchild. I had never heard that before. I mean, I knew that he was trying to produce the Moonchild. That wouldn't be
okay,
the result.
You know what? That might have been – that's a mistake on my part. You're right. He did not call himself the Moonchild. If he did, I must admit I'm a really I'm a very desultory researcher. And I remember the connection from somewhere, but I'm going to go with what you're saying. That it was that they – that they tried to produce. I thought it was Crowley that tried to produce the Moonchild. You see, the reason that I think this, I'm almost 100% certain, is that it's either at the Gutenberg archive or somewhere. They have the complete published works of Crowley. And they're in a letter, I am almost 100% certain. I roll a lot of on it, that the Crowley himself referred to Parsons as the Moonchild.
I think he referred to him as like bratty children, that they would attempt to do such a thing.
Right. It's true. Yeah, he was. So he's his successor, and he's the one to produce the Moonchild.
Okay.
And so, but then the thing I go into in my chapter is that there's no, as far as I've seen, I'm not, I mean, I've researched to the best of my ability under my circumstance and my position of being having information available to me, but it doesn't seem that they go into it, too much detail around what, other than a fictional novel, of what is actually meant by this Moonchild.
Okay, fair enough.
So, but then I see the symbolism of the white and the black lodge in the book by Crowley, Moonchild, and I was taking that in regard with the Go Board, which is totally plausible considering that it is a representational way of playing with the I Ching, truth be told, so that as you create eyes on the Go Board, you could be looking at this as a interplay of the White and Black Lodge. Basically, their feud is actually the feud of the dynamics of the vacuum. And so that, like what I was saying about Black Swan being the same story as Pi, you could also take that as interplay of the lodges and a breaking down. Now, you also have the red and the blue lodge, which is the way that it translates in not reality, but in the actual masonry. You have this the East and the West, or not necessarily the Europe and the American lodges. Right. Being red and blue is so appropriate in terms of like the crossover between the eyes and the brain, and you know, when you put on 3D glasses, why they work, you know, they are the two poles make a transcendent dimension. So I see the what's going back and forth between the red and blue lodges, especially today. There's a whole giant feud happening, which is definitely reminiscent of the feud that's presented in Moonchild. And so it seems that Moonchild is rather prophetic in that regard.
But isn't it just, I mean, it seems so simple, too, from a non-magical perspective, to say that Parsons' magic with L. Ron Hubbard informed him, which integrated into his research, into rocketry, right? And so his discoveries from rocket fuel led to the first ships going to the moon, right? So he had a hand in that. And I don't know, have any astronauts that have gone to the moon come back down to Earth and fathered children?
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, on a very literal, level, the workings of magic between Parsons and Hubbard literally created a moon child. You know, I mean,
that is quite frightening. That's a frightening thought. Yeah.
I mean, just divorced from the rhetoric, it actually happened. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, alchemical stuff. You know, you can turn lead into gold. It just defeats the purpose of profitability nowadays, right? You can smash the atoms together to create, you can create gold. It just, there's no purpose to it. There's no power in it. But they were right, you know? What was laughed upon and what was the charlatry of alchemy, which was really the sort of foolish byproduct that you could sell it for, it actually exists in reality, which I think is sort of like the I Ching or tarot, is that you could probably tell someone's fortune with it, you could predict events with it, but it happens so rarely that it's unreliable, you know? Mm. But it can actually do that in a literal sense. So I don't know. I think that, I don't know. I think Crowley's assessment in the late 40s to think that they could actually go to the moon probably was as absurd as their ambitions to actually do the magical thing.
Right.
Well, that depends. I mean, if you look into the so-called Vril Society, though, you might not think that. I mean, the idea of
saying on a superficial level from the general consensus belief.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You're right.
Jules Verne talking about the submarine. They're just like, what? What the sand is that?
Yeah.
Very fantastical, which ties us back to the master. But that wasn't, I mean, it's still naval. But the argument that you guys are familiar with is the idea for every Apollonian action, there's a Dionysian reaction. And that is something that's recognized within the mystery schools to a very high degree. And so that any feat that we accomplish in rocketry or otherwise has a simultaneous effect. So any movement towards oppression or dominion or domination has a liberating effect simultaneously that's a mutually interdependent counterbalance to it. And so that was what I took as the Moonchild, was the counterbalance to the propulsion. So you propel in a certain direction, and there's some unforeseen force that happens in reaction to that. And that is the result of the dynamics of the tree itself, and is keeping that awareness. So as somebody could just look at the atomic bomb and go, what a devastating threat to all existence, there's inevitably just as high a degree of a liberated effect that happens in the midst of that. So that's what I take as the Moonchild. The moon is the direct compensation to the sun, and reflects the potential to a higher degree.
Yes, but we seem to be experiencing these things in, like, what you've described makes sense in a holistic sense, where everything is balanced out with its natural opposite. But we still have the problem of our experience of linear time, right? So the coming of a Moonchild represents a breakdown of certain types of securities that we have taken for granted in linear time, like, you know, things like nations and gender lines and whatnot. All these ideas are breaking down. I mean, the list of long-held beliefs that are breaking down before our eyes is a pretty long list. And some of these beliefs were held up to a very high standard. And now we have people like Obama literally turning the Titanic around, making statements that would have been considered to be political suicide only 30 years ago, basically.
Right.
So,
that Apollo is also the destroyer.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, totally. But what I wonder, so you're talking about the natural balance of a system, but let me propose this idea. Let's say that somehow within that system that balanced itself out, there came a type of awareness that the system could be continually pushed in one direction only, basically. So that, like, almost like karate or something like that, you know, where you use the counterbalance of a negative force against you, you use that to generate positive force yourself to deliver a harder blow, essentially. And so do you think it's possible? I'm just curious if that could be happening or may have happened, because I think it fits the idea.
Clearly, I see what happened with the Book of the Law and what happened with Scientology is laying down the template that will influence the way that expresses itself. So in a sense, yes, it's pushing a pendulum back, knowing that it'll fall. But that's part of it too, is the only point that I'm making. So if you make an Apollonian movement where you instill a belief structure, that belief structure, like any the Babylonian Tower, is destined to fall to pieces. But out of that comes something new that is ultimately unpredictable. If that makes sense.
The Germans came up with television, and it was probably the crowning jewel in their whole future vision of a completely controlled state with propaganda, so much so that they wheeled in televisions into German villages in the late 30s to broadcast or to show the Olympics, which is just ridiculous.
How do I cut everyone's head off all at once?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing. But what initially evolved out of the intention to control and to brainwash led to the personal computer, which is now liberating thought and giving people more freedom to make choices on what they – people are tuning in their own square, you know what I mean? Whatever the square of television broadcast, which was programming, now people are choosing their own fragmented, remixed programming.
Right. It becomes malleable. It's malleable programming, yes. I said that statement, and then it struck me that Alex DeLarge in Clockwork Orange, what's his actual name? I'm spacing.
Burgess.
What, no. I meant the actor, but yes.
Okay. Yeah.
McLaren, Marshall.
Shit. I almost had it, but anyways, whatever.
Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell. He plays Caligula, right?
Right.
And Caligula was the man who his main aspiration was: how do I direct the consciousness of everybody all at once?
Yes. There you go. Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. Fuck.
That's beautiful.
Is the ultimate expression of that influence, right? And so, isn't it interesting that A Clockwork Orange hold the eyes open, forced to watch the things in order to dictate the behavior? How that connects? I'm just saying that that's a really interesting thing, and also that it's A Clockwork Orange. It's expressing the orange is the sun. There you have the Apollonian cycle. And that the whole thing is expressing itself as a means of control, that something he ends up like yielding to overcome, in a sense. He maintains the power through yielding to overcome. Like, he yields to overcome. He goes with the program. There's the argument that he's faking it. And then he's unable, even though he's faking it to this degree where he wants to get out of jail, he's still being affected by an aspect of it. So the Beethoven, he can't fake. It's really happening. He's really being disturbed.
Yes, very nice.
Else he can do. But even though it's a fantasy, it's still affecting him on some level.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting. Right. Yeah, that the theory that he totally fakes it does break down under that whole Beethoven idea. And it's interesting that it's the Ninth Symphony, isn't it, in the movie? The Ode to Joy. So what we're having then is his concept of joy is being destroyed, basically. Yeah.
Number nine, Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, of course. Wow. This is getting heavy, man.
We're back to the ninth gate.
Yeah.
So the gate of light, who wrote that? There's a really amazing Kabbalist who was one of the biggest Kabbalistic treaties is actually the Gate of Light, and I can't remember his name, but that goes into all the very things that we're talking about here. It's a long thing to go into, but it's worth looking at the Gate of Light in reference to the Ninth Gate, is what I'm saying. I don't have a copy of it, but I've looked at it before and it kind of blew my mind a little bit. It's a lot like Ramak. It's a different approach to Kabbalah as far as I'm concerned, it's a little bit more intelligent than, Madonna Kabbalah, like I was saying about that Dark Horse film, you know, like when he says, I'm not talking about Madonna.
Yeah. Kind of lame.
What I went into with Jan Irving that we got into a lot of heat around was that I'm expressing that a number of Kabbalists, including the one who wrote The Gate of Light, was not primarily concerned with the idea of ascension, of the aspirant ascending the tree. That is something that they'll go into to a degree, but it's not the main emphasis. The main emphasis is actually on the descent. Of energy and everything like descending upon us,
and that's a Gnostic thing because the descent is it's almost like you're talking about how light and dark are necessary components of each other. Well, this is the thing: is that the purpose of light is to shine into the darkness, right? So the whole concept of being light, in the positive sense, and then falling down to illuminate the darkness, is that exact same thing. It's not really the opposite of ascension, because the light will inevitably ascend back up again, like in some kind of cycle, essentially.
Two different kinds of lights, and that's a whole big old thing to get into. That's emphasized with the the creationist. So when you look at the Sefer Yetzirah, that's a point that's emphasized, is that the creation basically happens twice, and that the initial light is a different light. So when we're talking about Ein Sof, we're not talking about the same light that casts its shadow. The shadow is a different kind of shadow as well. And so it's a whole big old thing to get into, is the layers of that. I mean, Adam and Eve don't get skin until they leave the garden. People take it as clothing, but the words are, very
which indicates that the book of Genesis and subsequent books contain within them some type of genetic experiment, like the creation of some type of beast. Because if we're talking about them leaving the Garden of Eden, is the moment they have their skin, that could be called, you know, that would be the moment that the being itself, the whatever Frankenstein thing that it is, would come to life, essentially.
Yeah, you could also argue that we're emphasizing emanation.
You're right. That's perfectly true. Yeah, that's perfectly true. I have the bad tendency of seeing it the other way, but you're absolutely right. It does work that way, as emphasizing, as realizing an emanative property. Yeah.
Right. I can appreciate that idea of the genetic expression, and this doesn't necessarily deny that possibility or that way of looking at it. It's just emphasizing that the introduction of the idea of the other, that initially in consciousness there is no other. There is just, and when
I get it. I totally get it. I see that it's true, and yet I find. Go ahead.
Hermes, the divine Pymander, the Trismegistus. There's a few different ones, you know, when you look at that. But the one where he meets with the dragon, and the dragon tells him the story of creation and how much. Else, this was most likely in the Library of Alexandria, which was burned down, the original Egyptian version, as well as the Greek, or the, you know, people make the argument about the Library of Thoth and all this stuff, which is totally whatever, that's beside the point. But the interesting way that the Adam gets presented in there with the veils, that the man looks into the veils and is mesmerized and goes down seven rings.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you were talking about TV before, you say, I think somebody, one of you guys quipped, how do you chop off everybody's head at once? And I thought to myself about that image from Videodrome, the Cronenberg film, where the character played by James Woods literally sticks his head into the TV. Sure. And what's on the TV is a woman's lips, basically.
Uh-huh.
So he's decapitating himself. That's Adam. That's the Adam forcing his head through these veils, basically. Sure. That's what we're doing when we engage with media. We're forcing our heads through a series of veils. We're being born.
Mm-hmm. That's Poltergeist with Carol Ann.
Same thing.
Held in the placement of Malkuth at the base of the tree by the beast, which is the sun, which is Tiferet. This is a little different. You could take it not necessarily as ultimately as the heir Tiferet, but as this other being that's being held in its place. There's this idea that you'll see in, I don't know if it goes before like the 15th century, but there's this Kabbalistic idea of the underside or the shadow of the tree, which is where you have these demons taking over the tree, basically. And that's where the idea of the Lamed Lamed gets introduced.
The double L for hell. Yeah.
And so,
fascinating. Well, at the very bottom of the tree of the demonic life is, I guess, where we're going to wrap it up, guys. Hey,
yeah. Oh, are we through?
Yeah, I got to get ready for work.
Okay, cool.
So, I think we got a solid 3 hours in.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, yeah, I've enjoyed this a great deal. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for being able to join us on short notice, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it a lot.
Alrighty, bro.
Peace out, guys.
Any parting thoughts for you guys?
No matter in life, whatever you know, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole.
It's good enough for me.
It's truly pathetic.
If you keep your eye on the hole with a W, you're kind of keeping your eye on the donut despite your...
Perfect.
Good. All right,
moving on. Keep your eye on the W.
Bye.
All right,
guys.
Talk to you guys later. All right.
I give you facts. But don't give me facts. What facts? They are fucking attacked. What the? Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you. Don't you care? Fuck you. Fuck you. fucking lazy ass piece of shit.
I'm not lazy.
I'm done. You're fucking lazy.
No, you bitch.
You're fucking lazy.
I'm legitimately
you.
You're so mean.
Oh, they do. Who fucking likes you except for me?
Nobody.
Except for me.
Oh, you fucking.
Who likes you except for me? Except for me.
You shut up.
I'm the only one who likes you.
You.
Just me, Freddy.
Just you.
I'm the only one that likes you.